Welcome to VMN Volume 3, Episode 30. The date is January 19th, 2024. VMN is produced and transmitted from unceded Abenaki territory of so-called Vermont. Before we get started, I want to plug the GoFundMe for Daryl Lamont Jenkins. Daryl is a longtime anti-fascist activist who has come on hard times due to medical issues. He needs time to recover from an illness. If you can, and if you will, please visit his GoFundMe at https://www.gofundme.com/f/a-fighter-is-fighting and send him a few dollars. Any amount of money is appreciated. And now, on to the episode. This episode is an interview with the authors of the statement at leftrenewal.net on the left in general and on the horrible situation in Gaza and Israel. The statement in its entirety was read in the previous episode, episode 29. The authors are Ben Gidley, Daniel Meng, and Daniel Randall. Ben Gidley and Daniel Meng are here today. Welcome. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself? Since your microphone is not muted, why don't we start with you? Where are you? What is your activism? What brings you to write such a statement?
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm speaking from London, where I live. I guess I've been a kind of rank and file activist in various causes, in particular anti-fascism, in my trade union and anti-racist organization, and then going further back in kind of environmental protests, a whole range of things. So mainly in London, where I've lived for the last quarter century or so.
So Daniel, where are you and what is your background? What brings you to write this statement?
I'm in Sweden at the Arctic Circle in a little town. I've lived in a few countries in Europe, Germany, France, the UK and Sweden, past 10 years in Sweden. Yeah, and like I'm originally come out of the German radical left and yeah, it started, I guess, in the late 80s, at least that's when I met it. People started thinking about anti-Semitism on the left. And so that's been a topic that's, yeah, been more or less always on my mind. I'm a health worker, and I try to organize in a syndicalist fashion with other health workers, and I've always been into feminist gender issues, anti-racist. I think about racism a lot, I could go on, but guess I could say that it was I know Ben and the other Daniel from this discussion group. So we're not actually all that well acquainted personally. But we can get into that maybe in the next step. So much about me.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States, there's been some level of anti-Semitism around the Palestinian rights movement. Luckily, in Vermont, it's not been very intense, though we did have one speaker at a Palestine rally start talking about how the Jews were deluded. And he's gone. I maintain a list of fascists and bad actors, and he has gone into what we call the rogues list, because I don't want to see him speaking at rallies when he's putting out anti-Semitic stuff, at least until he has recognized the problems with this. I understand the problems in Europe have been more intense with anti-Semitic thought in the movement.
I guess it's important to say it's not a feature of the whole movement, and it's definitely not the case that kind of there's a mass mobilization of anti-Semites as a result of the Solidarity for Palestine, and you know, most people who are protesting and angry and active, you know, committed anti-racists. But there is, on the one hand, a kind of smaller current of hardcore anti-Semites who are using these mobilizations as a way of kind of mainstreaming their message in left audiences in a very conscious and deliberate way. And then there's maybe a wider issue of a kind of lack of understanding of anti-Semitism and of people being drawn to anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, people not thinking of them as anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, but nonetheless kind of drawn to them and drawn to kind of other ways of thinking that open the gate to anti-Semitism, and in particular drawing on that kind of reservoir of anti-Semitic narratives and myths at times when Israel kind of gets into the public attention. So the more passions are aroused around Israel, the more we see that kind of that pool being drawn on.
There's a fascist in the United States named Matt Heimbach. He's connected with European and Nazi movements, and he was trying to market himself as a leftist. He tried to join the Democratic Socialist of America. They kicked him out. And he has spoken at some of these bizarre red-brown anti-war actions. Is that something you're seeing, this red-brownism, a lot?
Okay, I can take it. Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit ill at ease with generalizing about Europe, because like I said, I've lived in a few European countries, but Eastern Europe, which is like a lot of different countries, very different from each other, is quite hard to wrap your head around. And like, even the Italian or the Spanish left, I mean, I speak a few languages, but if you don't speak the language, really to have an understanding of what's going on in the society in general and the left in particular is pretty hard. So I don't, we can't speak to what's going on in Europe, maybe what's going on in like the countries we know. And like, I'd say that in the Anglosphere, like, from Australia to the US via the UK, red brownism is like a thing. In Germany, it's definitely a thing. There's like a whole faction of the Die Linke, like the ex-communist left party that's gone like national, more than nationalist, like anti-migrant. That's the way to reconnect with the working class, is to be homophobic and anti-migrant. And similar tendencies in France, you have it everywhere. Ben, please, or anyone, correct me, add.
I don't think we've had too many cases in Europe around with quite such kind of explicit, the Matthew Heimbach case is kind of such a clear-cut case of a kind of hardcore fascist marketing themselves within the left and getting some acceptance from, not most leftists, as you say, DSA kicked him out, but from a significant kind of current of people posing as, anti-imperialists and so on. So that's a really clear-cut case. So we haven't maybe had such kind of strong examples here in the UK, but we do have kind of figures, organizations, forums, kind of talking forums that meet in London that have invited both fascists and left-wing speakers, Holocaust denialists who kind of like, share space. We've seen, for example, the former Labour MP in the UK, George Galloway, who's generally thought of as a kind of left-wing figure. I mean, this week he was on the podcast of this guy, Stu Peters, who's a pretty hardcore fascist. And that's by no means the first kind of fascist podcast that Galloway has been on. He's had fascist guests on his own radio shows. So he's a, a good example. And if you challenge him, most people on the left kind of recognize he's a problematic figure, but he still gets a lot of people defending him, a lot of people supporting him. And it's interesting that at times like now, when Israel-Palestine is the kind of issue that's that's at the forefront, people that might have distanced themselves from that kind of current are less likely to kind of draw clear lines than they would be at kind of other times, because they feel that the emergency is, you know, serious, that you take what allies you can get, which we think is a really dangerous temptation.
Yeah, in the United States, I guess that a similar character. There's this folk singer, and I can't remember his name. He whitewashed.
Rovix.
Yeah, I'm trying to forget it. That he even exists. He's similar. One of the things I've been noticing is the tendency for conspiracy-minded people to take anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and give them a paint job to attack whoever the scapegoat of the day is, whether it's trans people or whether it's migrants or whatever. Can you speak to the greater trend of these theories being generalized and how they always circle back to Jewish people in the end?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what we say in the Left Renewal text is that the world today is a really kind of opaque, the workings of power and privilege, the kind of complex relationship between what's going on in different parts of the globe demands a kind of explanation. People are looking for answers and explanations, and there's a lack of political literacy. Like we talk about, for example, the kind of a crisis of class analysis in the last few decades, that in that kind of context, people turn to the explanations provided by conspiracy theories. Many people get into conspiracy theories that aren't kind of initially necessarily anti-Semitic, but sooner or later, once you get into that milieu, you know, it doesn't take long before you kind of find at first maybe euphemistic or kind of covert anti-Semitic theories, and before long more explicit ones, because I think that they call that kind of way of thinking, it calls for an explanation of some kind of hidden power behind. Once you start scratching away, people become very distrustful of the kind of sources of knowledge which they've been, you know, previously thought were legitimate, and they become very credulous towards the kind of sources of knowledge put in front of them on the internet by the entrepreneurs of panic around the conspiracy scene. And so you're looking for some controlling force. There's always a controlling force behind that controlling force, another one behind, and pretty much always you either get back to the Jews or you get to a kind of myth that is based on anti-Jewish conspiracy theories, because they run really deep in our culture and kind of Christian culture and the globalized Christian culture, I suppose. So there's a very long menu of kind of deeply culturally embedded stories about Jews that people turn to, and they may not know that that's what they're turning to at first, but once you enter that territory, it's not long before you reach that place.
Daniel, do you have more to add to that?
I was just thinking about this is because we've been talking about the right in the U.S., fascists, and I think we're talking, at least I think in the text we try to address like different kinds of gradations of anti-Semitism, and of course a bunch of other types of racism. We also address the problem that anti-Semitism in this, what we call truncated anti-racism, that anti-Semitism is not recognized as a form of racism, that the equation of Jews equals white is made a bit too quickly and unproblematically, to put it lightly. So, I'm fine with this line of discussion that we've had. I just wanted to point out that, like, we're also talking about not just sort of what could be described as right-wing anti-Semitism on the left, but also specific of the left anti-Semitism and Islamist anti-Semitism, or however you want to call it, and whatever other kinds there might be, and also you know, more conscious and completely unconscious reproducing of stereotypes And the last thing that I wanted to throw into this chaotic mix of what I just said is that we also have discussions with and signatories from pretty far flung corners of the world. And I see that the way Israel-Palestine is viewed by leftists in India or in East Asia is influenced by a certain, I would say, Stalinist or authoritarian leftist tradition that reproduces anti-Semitic stereotypes. But of course, the people who sort of receive and reproduce these ways of seeing, like in India, there's no Jewish tradition. There was a tiny Jewish community, but people don't know who Jews are, and like there's no anti-Semitism. There was never. And so they're completely innocent. The culture is completely innocent of the, you cannot compare it to Eastern Europe or the United States or Western Europe. So it's, I guess what I'm saying is very complex. Very many different kinds and gradations of anti-Semitism that are received in different ways and reproduced in different ways in different corners of the world.
One thing that irritates me is the Twitterization of politics. When you try to say something is complicated, they accuse you of deflecting. You're just trying to get away from recognizing that this is white supremacy when things are complicated. It's a lot of black and white thinking, which I think, you know, it comes from trauma and it comes from the nature of the media, of the medium of internet. One thing that frustrates me a lot of the time, and I want you to react to this, is that a lot of people will say, well, it's older people, it's boomers, they don't have any literacy, they believe anything they see. What is your reaction to this line of thinking? I mean, I'm an older Gen X person. My wife is a late boomer, and neither of us are simplistic black and white internet thinkers, and that's why we were attracted to what you had to say. Can you discuss a little bit?
Maybe I'll just say something about the kind of the binary way of thinking and the internet, and then think about the generation issue. I think you're absolutely right that there's a kind of particularly in the kind of social media age, calls for simplistic thinking, it calls for binary thinking, it calls for kind of good guys and bad guys. I don't know if that's totally a new thing. There's always been a tendency towards, you know, heroes and villains and a simplistic view of the world, but definitely the kind of form of debate on social media really encourages that. And I suppose in our text, a lot of people have pointed out it's ridiculously long. We kind of caveat everything. We kind of, everything we wanted to say, we realized we had to kind of explain what we meant because it's not kind of part of the received wisdom. And there's a danger in that kind of insisting on complexity, insisting on nuance, that you kind of, you know, there's a danger of losing moral clarity. And it's a legitimate point to say, you know, at a time of emergency when people are being killed, you know, too much nuance can be not always a good thing, but we strongly believe that the kind of refusal of nuance that has become dominant is really problematic. And it's problematic in anti-racism, where, you know, the kind of binary understanding of race, US kind of US-centric binary understanding of race has been globally exported. It's true with kind of Israel-Palestine, where it's seen as like a two-sided thing with ignoring a lot of complexity. So I don't know if that's an issue that, this, you're talking about different generations. I mean, I think there's some evidence now that millennials are starting to be more receptive to anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. After, if you look at kind of attitudinal research going back decades, there seems to have been a generational shift with a decline in all sorts of forms of bigotry. And in Eastern and Central Europe, you're now seeing the reverse of that, with younger people often having much more kind of reactionary views on the kind of issues of, you know, gender, race, you know, anti-Semitism and so on, but there's some evidence from UK and US that millennials are starting to be kind of more conspiracy minded. So I think there's kind of particular issues around kind of long-term left activists, and there's particular issues around kind of newly radicalized people that are kind of experiencing movement activism for the first time. I don't think you can kind of point the finger at one group more than another.
I was rereading parts of Zionism in the Age of Dictators by Lenny Brenner. And one thing that struck me the first time I read it, it was 20 plus years ago. I was younger. I was much more of a hothead. And then I reread the section when it talks about Menachem Begin, who's this awful reactionary. But even in this anti-Zionist text of Lenny Brenner's, it talks about how he was kind of forced, even Begin was forced out of Poland to leave for Israel, because even the Polish who were fighting against the reactionaries were saying they were going to come for the Jews next. And I had not remembered that part of the text. My family's complicated. I'm Jewish, I'm American, and I had Polish step-parents, a stepfather. And through the Polish side, there were some, my great aunts fought against the Nazis, and they knew Menachem Begin. They never forgave him for abandoning them fighting the Nazis, but they weren't seeing the anti-Semitism of the Polish movement, which was just absolutely horrifying. And they were saying, you know, the same thing about wiping out the Jews as the Nazis were. I mean, that wasn't the Jewish part of my family, but they knew him, and he was their comrade, and then he abandoned them. But they didn't see that part of the issue. Back to the statement. Sorry about the derailment.
No, but that's not a derailment. I mean, I think we're in the middle of it. Like, where we get some of the angriest pushback is like that is about basically our contention that some critiques or feelings towards Israel and Zionism that circulate in left movements in general and pro-Palestine movements in particular are colored by anti-Semitism of some degree and in some way. And that's most unacceptable and most uncomfortable. Or I don't know, I assume it's uncomfortable, whatever, we get that is something we're saying, and we're trying to say sort of, we're trying to gesture, like, Ben, correct me if I'm going completely in the wrong direction here, but I think we're trying to gesture at an analysis or a view of Zionism as both national liberation and colonial, having a doubleness, and we don't, as we mentioned in the text, we don't throw out the settler colonial analysis of Israel at all, but we take exception to the some of the analysis that's being presented, and especially some of the political consequences and sort of the emotional tone that's being justified with it. Like, basically, why don't they all go back to Poland or something? Or like every Israeli baby is a settler and has no right to be there, and so on and so on. That is like part of the uncomfortable. Yeah, the most uncomfortable part of the text and the discussion around it.
I was talking with you about your statement with a comrade. Then one of the things he had actually noticed is pre 1947, pre Nakba, there were Jews in Israel, Palestine, that were fighting the British, and he had actually seen people try to justify British imperialism in Palestine because it was against these awful Zionists. And it was like, I can't approve of the bombing of the David Hotel that the revisionist Zionists did, but that's fighting the British. That's was the right thing to do, you know. And they weren't being horrible. The British were not on the right side of that because they were opposing the Zionists.
Yeah, and it's become like a really standard belief that imperialism has always supported Zionism, and British imperialism in particular has always supported Zionism. And people tell a story that includes the Balfour Declaration. It includes the kind of the fact that it was under British colonial rule that the Zionist movement really established a foothold in Palestine. It's not a completely false story. There's definitely points at which, you know, British imperialism has been absolutely central to the story of both Zionism as a movement and to the state of Israel as a kind of state project. But there've also been other moments when, you know, Britain blocked migration to Palestine, when it kind of tried to kind of find a way of support, you know, parts of the British state were supportive of Arab nationalism. They kind of thought that this racial nationalist view of the world, where they kind of thought of both the Jews and the Arabs as kind of racial nations that deserved homelands. And at other times, you know, the Zionist movement saw itself as a anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist movement that was related to other anti-colonialist movements across the kind of imperial world. And those histories aren't the kind of beginning and end of the story. You can't look at what's going on in Israel now and say, you know, it's okay because there were once, you know, left-wing Zionists, or because Zionism was once anti-imperialism. It's not a way of kind of deflecting from what Israel is doing now. And certainly it shouldn't be, but there's a kind of complexity that defies some of the stories that people just believe in the kind of in the Western left, at least, and I think in other parts of the world as well.
That kind of reminds me of a beloved comrade who has died on the 31st, Cleve Benali. He is a Diné anarchist. He was at an anarchist convention, and he warned that utopians have also colonized our people.
Yeah, it's a really good point.
And I think people lose the complexity. Like, I have Palestinian comrades who feel like they have, I'll quote them, they have clowns on the right and monsters on the monsters on the right and clowns on the left. You have on the right wing, you have people who want to turn back the clock on any human rights, you know, the Islamist. And on the left, you have the PFLP that is supporting the Bashar Assad government, which, you know, when I learned about that, I was horrified, because I liked their politics until I knew that. And it's like, my friend who was Palestinian kind of set me right about that. It was a very interesting night that we spent together on the internet. We were actually watching old Yiddish movies and songs together, talking about politics. It's not what most people would expect of a Palestinian activist.
That relationship between what's been going on in Syria in the last decade or more and what's going on in Israel and Palestine now and other things in the wider region and globally, I think it's really, really important part of the, I guess, the lens that we bring to how we've come to understand what's going on. I mean, for me personally, having, I guess, been watched what's happened in Syria, in particular in the last decade, it's impossible to escape comparisons with the way that Israel has acted in Gaza in terms of, you know, the use of this kind of war on terror language to justify the destruction of infrastructure, hospitals, health workers, you know, exactly the same language from Assad as from the Israeli government now, the kind of double tap hits where a target is civilian target, like a, you know, hospital is hit and then hit again as the rescue workers arrive. So it's kind of watching something similar unfold, but also and the language used to justify it, crucially, that kind of war on terror language that a large part of the left weirdly accepted when it was Assad using that language, or when it's Russia or China using that language against Islamic movements, Muslim populations in those countries. That kind of idea of, you know, the Syrian revolution portrayed as like bloodthirsty jihadi fanatics in a kind of classic Islamophobic way was accepted by a huge part of the left. And now we're seeing a lot of the figures who justified those war crimes or denied those war crimes that Assad was committing, chemical attacks, and, you know, including attacks on Palestinians in Syria, such as the siege of Yarmouk, tens of thousands of Palestinians killed by Assad. And the people that justified that or even denied it are now kind of retailing themselves as the kind of face of Palestinian solidarity in quite a kind of a way that I know, you know, my Syrian friends find deeply offensive, but should offend anyone who cares about Palestine.
Yeah, I had a friend who I helped him compile the videos that the Syrian police were putting on YouTube of them torturing people, because the Syrian government, when they tried to cover it up, had all those removed. So one of the groups I worked with back in 2011, we compiled all this stuff so that it wouldn't be disappeared from memory. So if there was ever, Assad was ever called to account, it would be there. And my friend just ended up having a nervous breakdown from just dealing with this material. My circles, I'm very lucky. We don't have any of the Russia Putin justifiers or this Assad justifiers, but that doesn't mean it isn't here. It just means our group does not tolerate this, and we actually try to cut the feet out from under this kind of activism. How much of the old organized left that's campist is in the parts of Europe that you watch?
I think that campism, which I think is the best term for that kind of translation of that binary thinking into geopolitics. So the kind of enemy of the near imperialism is seen as resistance, has become a really, really kind of powerful force on the left, not just in people that kind of like really embrace Putin or embrace the idea of a multipolar world that he's promoted. I mean, there are people that for whom it's really central to their ideology, but I think it's spread quite widely beyond that. And you see it in the kind of in the way that a lot of people who weren't, you know, saw Assad as a dictator and as a bad person, but nonetheless thought, you know, American imperialism and the American, they were much more kind of concerned about American bombs on his Air Force runways than they were about his bombs on civilians. So yeah, I think it's kind of a really, really powerful force on the left. And that idea of a kind of multipolar world, I mean, Daniel could probably speak more about that, but this sort of idea of that it's appealing to many people on the left that there are other, what we would see as other imperialisms and other kind of capitalist imperial powers fighting for control of our planet, that they see that as a good thing rather than, you know, as a sort of source of comfort because American imperialism is seen as the kind of by far the worst imperialism, is like a really widespread position.
One thing I think needs to be mentioned, And correct me if I am wrong, the idea that when we hear about this term multipolar world, we're talking about the ideology of Dugin, who is the he's Rasputin to Putin. He's the person whispering in Putin's ear, and he wrote this, I believe it was the Foundations of Geopolitics, where this term is used. And Dugin is a quintessential fascist thinker. He was a founder, I believe, of the National Bolshevik Party in Russia, which is a fascist movement, despite using the name Bolshevik. Can we go into a little bit more about how this idea from the far right has infiltrated into the left's thinking?
Maybe I'll try to add quickly. Like we talked about the Progressive International, which is this basically combo of some Sanders people and some Europeans around this Greek Yanis Varoufakis and his project. Anyway, they're actually quite big and quite relevant on the global left. I mean, like on the whole, of course, they're irrelevant, but within what you could call the left, like if you count from anarchists to social democrats, within that spectrum, still not unimportant. Then I would say that, like, of course, you have all these ML, Marxist-Leninists groups that seem from some vantage point seem like, oh, they're completely irrelevant, like little sects, but in some countries, yeah, like India, the communist parties are still have intellectual, cultural, and partly in some places political influence, and they're in some ways Stalinist through and through. Maoism is not dead. There are Maoist insurgencies in the Philippines and in India and in places, you know, it's not over. And this way of viewing the world, of hoping for China, Russia, and South Africa, and like an optimistic version, like let's rope in India, is going to topple the unipolar world order, and that's going to be, you know, and that's going to bring benefits for the brown majority of the world. This illusion, or this reactionary illusion, is strong. And even some Trotskyists, I'm like, I have nothing to do with Trotskyism personally, but I do recognize that on geopolitical issues, they tend to be better than the Stalinists. But there are Trotskyists who are campists in some ways. There's even anarchists who flirt with these kinds of ways of viewing the world. And generally, I would say there's just a general desperation. Like the far left or radical left is like so small and so on the defensive and so powerless, basically everywhere, that you know, people grasp at, people project, people want to see some hope somewhere else. People want to desperately believe that there's some, you know, that there's like someone with power out there who's like fighting on in our corner, and it's just not the case. But we were, you know, I can almost understand that you'd like to believe it. And I feel with like okay, we're talking about this text, the Left Renewal text, but we do mention China in passing, and with people's like left disorientation about what China is it capitalist, is it imperialist, is it settler colonial, this is that last question is the question that most people don't even ask. There's so much confusion, and just lack of any attempt to find out like the most basic things about China, in many places. I mean, not just in the West. It's like it's just as bad in, like, if you talk to leftists in India, like many don't know nothing about China. This is just as bad as Swedes or American leftists. Okay, that's all. I'm done with my rant. Thank you.
Just on the campus issue of campism, I mean, for me, I'm not sure of the exact genealogy of that word and the kind of concept. I think in the sort of Cold War period, within the sort of dissident parts of the Trotskyist movement, anarchist movement, who kind of rejected who identified the Stalinist left and its fellow travelers as seeing the world divided into these two camps, the kind of, you know, the Western, these two blocks, these two armed camps, and that kind of camp thinking, kind of as or thinking in these camps as an alternative to actually thinking about what's going on. And I guess in that period of the Cold War, the kind of more radical position that I would identify with, that's, you know, maybe sometimes called the third camp sort of position or something like that, where neither Washington nor Moscow was the slogan of, you know, that part of the Trotskyist movement, kind of rejecting both powers to try and find a third force, and that third force was identified with the global working class that had no interest in either camp. I guess at the end of the Cold War, and what appeared initially to be a kind of unipolar world where America had won the Cold War, kind of threw that sort of thinking into crisis in a productive way. And I guess that's my activism in the 90s, that sort of movements against global capitalism, I think kind of like breathed a much freer air because they were no longer thinking in that way. What happened in particular after 2001 is that sort of way of thinking returned, but this time the alternative didn't even have the kind of vaguely the claims to some sort of emancipatory trappings that the Soviet Union kind of rhetorically endorsed. Now the kind of alternatives were explicitly reactionary, but the same way of thinking was repeated. And I think we kind of need to recover some sense of like what is the alternative, to look at the kind of grassroots movements, emancipatory movements, feminist movements, working class forces globally as the kind of alternative, that we have no interest, we have no stake in these imperialist powers. And I guess there's thinkers Yassin Al-Haj Saleh, who talks about liquid imperialism. He's a Syrian Marxist, and his kind of experience of the way that these different geopolitical camps have used Syria as a, you know, fighting their kind of imperial wars, and his land, he talks about this kind of liquid imperialism that promotes this idea of a kind of multipolar world, but really they're all kind of pursuing, you know, parallel sort of extractivist authoritarian projects, some of them, you know, more brutally than others.
Well, you've done a very good job of critiquing where the left has gone wrong in its thinking and the problem of anti-Semitism. But you two are going to kill me when I say this. I'm going to say the most stereotypical leftist phrase: what is to be done? So where do we go from here?
Well, can I just say that our first, I mean, we stumbled into this, you know, we were just like on this mailing list, and there was like general dismay after 7th October. And when we saw, you know, some left posters, like a poster with like a big, those flyers, the names, the is escaping.
Hang gliders with the...
Right, the hang gliders and this kind of stuff. And we're just like, no, like somebody has to say something. And so it was just like, we just wanted to express ourselves. And then we wanted to reach out to other people, because like we had the feeling that there might be other people who are either like frozen stiff, or like afraid to say something because all their colleagues like think differently or whatever. Anyway, so it was kind of like that, just say something, reach out to other people. So it was very modest. And then we produced this ridiculously long thing, and people told us this is ridiculous, to turn it into an article. And we said like, okay, we'll try. Maybe we'll get 15 signatures. And then we tried, and now we're at 190 signatures, and we're very surprised at where these people are coming from and how they heard of it and like what it's like. And so, you know, I'm just saying this to say, like we're like even less well prepared to answer the what is to be done question than if we were part of some group, because we're not. We're just like these three people who stumbled into writing this thing. But of course, this is, I don't want to avoid the question. Yeah. Okay. Over to you, Ben.
It's underline that kind of stumbling into kind of thing. And I guess the three of us have quite disparate political perspectives. We don't come from the same kind of tradition. Daniel Randall, our third co-author, is a Leninist, Trotskyist, which neither of us are, as you will tell from what we said so far. But so we don't have the same views on everything. And there's places in the text maybe where you can see that we kind of didn't necessarily kind of, you know, we had maybe compromised slightly with each other in a productive way. We don't have exactly the same views about kind of national self-determination, for example, or I don't know, the role of religion, fundamentalism, those sorts of things. We're not completely on the same page, but what we are on the same page about is that there is a kind of there are deep-seated problems on the left, which are not just about kind of optics. It's not just about like a few kind of people that have attached themselves to our movements, but that there are the reason those kind of bad actors who've attached themselves to our movements get an audience is because of a crisis in the way of thinking that many of our kind of comrades have. And I guess we've been struggling with those issues for years, and that this text was kind of written as a way of kind of trying to bring those our responses that we've had over the years to this particular moment of crisis. So, and I guess it's, you know, like kind of how can we overcome this kind of conspiracist thinking, this kind of campist thinking? Is it through a sort of renewal of class analysis, materialist analysis, looking at the geopolitics in a more sort of rigorous way, being more, you know, we're a bit suspicious of the kind of history of ideas of universalism, but that maybe kind of emancipatory movements that speak to, you know, the liberation of humanity, that we need to kind of rekindle that tradition. And certainly we're not going to be the people that do that, but we hope that maybe this resonates with others who are looking for that sort of way forward. And we've been pleasantly surprised to kind of meet fellow thinkers from Brazil to India, who've kind of who does it resonated with.
I mean, the way I heard the news of October 7th, I didn't hear about the killings. The first thing I saw was, you know, news of the wall coming down, and my reaction was, thank God. And then I see this horrible slaughter happens, and my heart just sunk. And you know, because none of us wants a wall, you know. But
yeah, I mean, that's a really, really important point. And I guess there's part of within Jewish communities, who often, many Jews feeling kind of beleaguered because of the rise in anti-Semitism, and perhaps have family in Israel and can feel these attacks very viscerally, don't necessarily see that for many people globally, yeah, those images of fences being cut, the images of kind of people kind of just walking into a space that they couldn't walk in before were, you know, images of liberation that caught people's imaginations. And there's something really important to hold on to there. And so a lot, you know, there's been many unjustified sort of fears of anti-Semitism around people expressing solidarity with Palestinian liberation whether out of fear or out of reactionary politics. And it's important to hold on to that moment of liberation, but also to kind of have clarity about the moment that then immediately followed, which was like morally obscene, that people that we were shocked to see how many people kind of either disapproved of it in a kind of throat clearing kind of way, or, you know, whether just got it out of the way to move on to the real thing, or even celebrated it. You know, been a quite you know, that it was a that was part of the emancipatory moment, which to us speaks to a really bad politics.
And my favorite group, one of the things that also frustrates me is people thinking of Israel in a monochromatic fashion. There's a lot of people in Israel who don't support this stuff. The group's not really around anymore, but about 10, 15 years ago, there was a group called Anarchists Against the Wall. It was a group of Israeli and Palestinian anarchists who basically they would just tear down border fences and go to border crossings and make sure that people got across safely. I mean, the Jewish people would make sure they had their kippahs on so that the soldiers would be less willing to shoot. And again, we're talking complexity, and a lot of leftists are afraid to do that now, because if you say, you know, all Israelis aren't on the same page with murdering people, wholesale slaughter and genocide, you know, they think you're trying to deflect. Again, that's what I liked about your statement so much. It had the complexity and the nuance.
Are we still talking about what is to be done?
Do you have more to say about it? I think you've kind of said, not us.
Well, okay. I think we've gotten some comments and pushback because we use the word democratic quite a lot. And obviously democracy can mean like anything and everything. I guess, at least from my perspective, this relates to the situation we're in with basically, yeah, fascism and right-wing populism on the rise from the US to India, yeah, like everywhere, including the country where I live, just in Sweden, where I feel, well, we don't have much choice but to have alliances with liberals against the far right. How do you do that without giving up your principled criticism of liberalism, including the racism of liberalism? Because there's this illusion that only the right is racist and that liberals are, you know, liberalism is racist in its own specific way. And I think it's important to hold on to that critique, but also to see that there's worse. And so that's one level of the democracy. Another democracy, why we're, for me at least, that's what this slogan evokes. Another is that you can take a term like democracy that's very well anchored, like they're accepted, that's a good thing. Everybody wants democracy, right? And fill it with meanings of economic democracy, grassroots democracy, direct democracy, and so on. Fill it with stuff that the more, that more moderate and conservative people don't want to have in there. And so that's a sort of a, at the level of discursive struggle, it makes more sense, especially in this situation where we're at the brink of, you know, like total defeat. It makes more sense to take a line that says democracy. We're not going to use that term because it's so tainted by hypocrisy and it's so meaningless. And you know, we're going to invent some other thing. We're going to say anarchism or whatever. It's not convincing to me as a propagandistic or discursive strategy. And the last level is that there is something was always wrong with how. What I call the authoritarian left, but I guess also the parts of the anti-authoritarian left, the disdain that sometimes, how disdainfully individual rights, civil rights are talked about. Like, yes, of course, we want to go beyond individualism, and yes, it's not like we're not into property rights and all that stuff. But you know, it just makes a difference to live in a country where there is a somewhat independent judiciary and where there's not. Yeah, and it bugs me that like I often on the far left I seem to hear a discourse that like doesn't distinguish between a shitty situation, a shitty bourgeois democracy like the United States and whatever Putin's Russia or things in between. Like there are just gradations. There's the flawed democracy of India. There's the very flawed bourgeois democracy of Israel plus occupation and apartheid that obviously no democracy at all for the occupied, but it's not the same as Putin's Russia. And yeah, and like we have, I think we have to make these distinctions. We just have to. So I wanted to talk a little bit about why we chose, or at least my view on like why we chose to use that talk about democratic rights, democracy. Yeah, Ben, do you want anything to add or correct here? Or?
No, I totally agree with that. I guess that democracy without illusions, without guarantees. And I guess that's something I think maybe for both the two of us, I'm not sure about the other Daniel, that we maybe learned from the anti-fascist movement, where there is, which has always been in tension with some parts of the rest of the left who kind of see, use phrases like social fascism, or that basically fascism is just another face of capitalism as usual. And I think as anti-fascists, that's something that we've kind of, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, I'm not sure, that this kind of has long kind of troubled me, that kind of like refusal to see these kind of differences and that they matter, that there's a qualitative difference between, as Daniel puts it, a flawed democracy and a deeply authoritarian state, or a deeply authoritarian state and an actual fascist dictatorship, that those are somehow just all the same, and that all that matters is the kind of geopolitics.
I want to add something. The thing I forgot to say is that, like, another thing that bothers me is the tendency to not be really all that self-critical, or like to not have I feel there's a lack of self-criticism of the whole of our left history. Like I've never been a Leninist. I'm not a Leninist. Still, I feel like I'm part of something that is responsible, for things like the big famines in China, or the famines in Stalinist Russia, or like the economic situation in Venezuela. Like, I mean, of course, like we can't just say like, oh, this is another, these are not this is not really socialism, this is not really left, we have nothing to do with it. That's too simple. Like, I mean, we fucked up like many, many times, and there's good reasons for people, for working class people, for whatever, sexual minorities, for women to not trust us, because we fucked up so many times. And like to really like take that on board and have a bit of more of a more humility, and not like take this attitude that's that gets pumped up even more in situations of desperation that we're in now. Like we totally know the right line, and we have this fantastic resistance that's pure and noble, and we're 100% behind it. And anybody who says different, there's an emotional complex there that's also a problem, if you know what I mean. Yes, thanks.
In a lot of ways, I feel like we're talking about cognitive distortions that we see in some way and we're trying to challenge. And it's important to understand that we may have our own blind spots to certain issues. I know I tend to be a very complex and abstract thinker, but there's places that I miss because I'm human. And what Daniel said, to have the humility to look at yourself and to be able to analyze what could be done differently. And it's important that we, in America, there's a lot of psychologizing things, and I don't want to put this thing in the realm of therapy, but because there are American listeners who will only listen, hear this, you have to be able to forgive yourself, or at least just see what you are. I don't like that way of putting it, but some people will only hear it that way. So is there anything more that we've been talking for about an hour? Is there anything more that you're burning to say before we close this interview?
No, it's been it's really nice that you reached out to us from Vermont. It's great to connect.
Thank you so much for the time. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Ben. And I will read us our closing. Is there anything you want to plug? Any projects that you want to promote other than leftrenewal.net?
No.
Excellent. So if you haven't read the statement, go to https://leftrenewal.net or listen to episode 29, where it will be read to you. If you like this podcast, please consider sharing and liking it on your social media. Reviews help drive the algorithms that basically run the internet world. So please, if you have the time, leave a review on your podcast aggregator. Reviews on Apple and Google help a lot, so if you are willing to deal with these companies, and only if you are willing to deal with these companies, leave reviews. Otherwise, tell your friends about the podcast. This was VMN Volume 3, Episode 30. VMN was formerly known as Vermont Movement News and can be found on podcast apps as Vermont Movement News. I will be leaving you with a wonderful recording of Deloy Polizze, played by the wonderful Monsieur Jacques, who is gracious enough to provide his music under Creative Commons licensing. Thank you.